Hey, Internet. He's John. I'm Mark. This is the Enthusiastic Cast, the web show where we endorse one awesome book. This week, I'm enthusiastic about Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card. But first, John, I want to chat about data-driven literary criticism. And the New York Times, I've been following, has a new column on the subject in their Sunday book section, or I'm reading it online, so I actually don't know what day it comes out, but whatever, where various psychologists and statisticians are now experimenting with literary works and or doing experiments that have like literary works at their center. And so I've sent you a couple examples of that, right? And in one particular case, there's these guys, well, it wasn't the New York Times that was reporting it, it was Wired Science, reported this week on a study of spoilers, and we've talked about that in pre-talk before, where these guys in a lab in San Diego were studying spoilers in literature. And particularly, they found the tension of not knowing the end of the story ruined the reading experience in literary works, or that was their data set, right? So what they're saying is all of our worry and brouhaha about avoiding spoilers is actually a new phenomena that's totally not worthwhile and it isn't actually hardwired into our brains, right? So I sent you that post. We'll include it in the show notes. And I just wanted to ask you, like, what do you think of this? What do you think of that experiment and this whole thing in general?
Well, a couple of things off the top. I don't think that the data set said that not knowing the ending of these stories, and they used stories from, you know, different genres and that had different types of spoilers inherent in them or things that could be ruined. And basically what they found was that people, when people knew the twists or when they knew what was coming, they enjoyed them more. Not that they didn't enjoy them when they didn't know, but they enjoyed them more when they, you know, when they knew in advance what was coming. And that's, I mean, for me, I've talked about how I'm, you know, I'm going on a hype diet and I feel like I've just been inundated with spoilers and I know too much about things before I go to see them or read them or what have you. And so this data runs counter to my intuition, but that's sort of the whole point of this data, right? Is that it's saying this whole notion that you shouldn't be spoiled is artificial. And I think we all know people who, you know, read the end of the mystery before they read the mystery, right? People who flip to the back of the book. A coworker of mine just spent the weekend in New York and went to see the, or was going to see the play War Horse, the Broadway play that's being turned into a movie by Steven Spielberg that's coming out this fall. And she was very concerned. I mean, when you, if you're familiar with drama at all, if you go to see a piece of drama called War Horse about a horse that goes to war, you kind of know, and no spoiler warning here, I don't know the ending of War Horse, but going into it, she was kind of concerned, you know, like I give this horse a 50-50 chance. And if this play ends with the, if this show ends with the horse dying, that's gonna, you know, that's gonna be bad for me because she's, you know, she's an animal lover. And so she was very busy looking up spoilers on Thursday before she left for her trip so that she could, you know, gird her loins and be sort of emotionally centered going into it, knowing what to expect. And I definitely think that that's one kind of reader. It's not the kind of reader that I am, but definitely that's one kind of reader. Also, I would be interested to know, you know, this is statistics, you know, it's a large study. And so I would be interested to know if there were within this large data set, a subset of people who enjoyed the stories more when they didn't know, right? Like that you can make broad sweeping generalizations, but is it true for all individuals within the set? That we don't have access to that data. So we don't know. And then finally, in the article, the author also makes the point that there's a difference between the big sort of twist ending spoiler or how the whole thing turns out and the subtle surprises of how a creative person, an artist, or a group of artists chooses to execute a story in the telling of that. And that's partially when I say I'm going on a hype diet and spoilers are ruining movies for me. That's partially what I'm reacting against. I'm not even reacting so much against knowing how The Sixth Sense turns out or knowing how, you know, Empire Strikes Back turns out. I'm more, you know, I've seen all of the design elements before I actually get to the film. I know pieces of dialogue. I've seen scenes excerpted. So it's not just knowing what happens in the end. Most things, most genre pieces, you're going to know what happens in the end. You know, the good guy saves the day, solves the crime, catches the bad guy, gets the girl, whatever, right? Just, you know, as the author pointed out, in Homeric times and forwards and backwards, the stories that people were told weren't stories that were surprising to them. They were stories that they'd been raised on since childhood, and it was all about the execution. So when I say that the current climate of knowing everything before you see something or read something is ruining it for me, what I mean is they're not just ruining the plot, they're ruining the execution as well.
So what did you make of this one group? So there's three groups in the study, right? So one group is told the spoiler up front in the preface. They get the whole thing. The second group has the spoiler embedded in the text, right? As if it's the author revealing the end of the story as a natural part of the mechanics of the story, right? Yes. Did you catch that?
Yes.
And I was like, that's fucking totally bogus, right? Like, when that, like, that's not even a spoiler, really, right? Like, what were the? I don't know if it was like a control group or whatever. It's not really explained in the summary of what they were up to. But it was like, you know, okay, so like in those police procedurals where you meet the killer in the first chapter. Right? Like, that's part of the story, right? So by turning a story where the big reveal is at the end and putting it at the beginning as if it's, like, that's actually a different story. You're not really measuring apples to apples at that point, right?
I think, though, what they are measuring there, I mean, one of the things that they talked about was the disappointment of inaccurate prediction, that one of the reasons that people don't like spoilers is when they get to the end, or sorry, when they one of the reasons that people do like spoilers is they hate to get to the end of something and be caught flat-footed or be surprised in a way that makes them feel dumb for not correctly predicting what was going to happen.
Boo fucking who, right? Like, I don't – anyway, yeah, okay.
It's just not that they're even consciously aware of that, right? But if you – I think that they were trying to measure the difference. Like, why is it that when we spoil it for people, they seem to, on balance, enjoy it more than when we that when we don't spoil it for them, and it's because they don't, you know, in all cases, you remove that element of, oh my God, it totally got me. And so I think that that's what that test group, that control group was testing for.
Oh,
right?
I see.
By revealing the spoiler in the story, you're eliminating that, right? You still get this feeling of, oh, it was a mystery, but you get it right every time because they told you.
Huh. So, well, and then, you know, I've got a couple problems. My other main problem is, okay, so you're in a lab setting, presumably, and you're being observed, I would think, as you're reading these stories. And someone comes along and it's just like, okay, so here's what's going to happen, right? Both in the story and like, you just need to read this, right? And it's like, oh, well, that removes all tension in the reader about being tested about what it's going to be about or being about, you know, having some comeuppance at the end where they're like, psych, you know, this wasn't really about, right? So I can imagine having a paragraph at the beginning of a short story in a lab setting would actually be a relief, right? That wouldn't necessarily be recreated if you were to come across that story in the wild, kind of thing.
I absolutely think you're right there. The lab setting itself may have increased the disappointment that people felt. The people who didn't have the story spoiled for them, you know, whatever they felt about whatever confusion they might have felt while reading the story was probably exacerbated by the test setting itself. So, yeah, based on this study, I don't think that there's enough here that people should just run out and just start reading Wikipedia articles on everything. Like, don't, you know, follow your bliss, kids, but that's not what I'm going to do.
So what do you make of this whole stimulus and response kind of scientification of literature?
Well, I feel I don't think it's going anywhere. I'm not a scientist, and obviously there's some really bright people who are working really hard, and it's and their hearts are in the right place, and they, you know, it's coming out of a love of literature, and they want to find a way to make literature more relevant in what they see as a science-based, science-driven, empirical world. But I, you know, there was the one article, the one in the New York Times, right, which was the underlying thesis seemed to be, don't read, let computers do it for you. They'll get it better and give you, they'll be able to read everything that's ever been written anywhere at any time, and they'll be able to give you a better view. You, with your frail mortal faculties, can't possibly hope to reach a, you know, a, read a significantly large enough sample size, and so whatever you get from reading will be woefully non-representative and therefore invalid, which seemed to go completely, you know, the other science-based literary study article was the one in the Quill and Quire, which was all about the impact of literature on people's personalities, right? And they've proved that literature affects people's personalities. In other news, water is wet. But those are both scientific studies looking at literature, one talking about, wow, you know, isn't this amazing? When people read literature, it's reshaping their psychology and it's affecting every person differently. And, you know, isn't this great? And isn't this a scientific basis for how important literature and reading literature is? And then the other one is like just taking the statistician's view. We think we can get a computer that can do this better and just leave your personalities alone. And they're just totally at loggerheads. And honestly, neither one, and it might be a failure of the articles about the studies because I haven't read the studies, neither one was compelling to me.
Yeah, so, you just end up, you just, it's like, I don't care.
I basically, coming out of all three of these articles, I was just like, well, I think I'm going to carry on how I'm carrying on with the reading and the fun and the trying not to spoil things for myself.
Okay, so then that's the perfect cue to move on then. So for the last 2 weeks, Ender's Game has been on the New York Times best-selling paperback list.
Really?
And I'm not sure why. Like, there's been a film in the works for years.
Forever, yeah. Wolfgang Peterson was going to direct at one point and then moved on, and I don't know where it is now.
and where's he moved on to? Right?
Like, yeah, that's true, too.
So, you know, I'm not aware of any, like, news out there that has prompted this resurgence of Ender's Game being, you know, a top bestseller, or maybe it's always been a top bestseller and it's just like been bouncing on and off the list for 25 years or whatever. But I, you know, I saw that and I was like, oh, I've never read that book. And so I thought that, you know, I might pick it up. So I read it this weekend, and all this time I kind of believed that it was, where I know that it is like for a certain set of computer geeks of a certain age, right. It's like a beloved story, right? So maybe there's more of those people reading. I don't know. But I cracked it this weekend, and well, I'm here to be enthusiastic about it.
Excellent. To preface this, you won't be trying to sell me this book because I read this book about 20 years ago when I was a teenager, and loved it then. Haven't read it since, but my memories of it are wholly fond. And actually, that was a book that completely surprised me. And that surprise was part of it was one of the things that I loved about it, just to tie it back to what we were talking about before. So at least 16-year-old me, very enthusiastic about this book.
Oh, okay. Well, that the reasons why you were kind of vague on, so maybe we'll get to that. But so like I said, I was vaguely aware that if you were really, really, really into computer games in 1985, you geeked out over this book in a big way. And so for all these years of like seeing it and encountering it, and let me tell you, it's one of those cases where that sci-fi cover has like totally put me off for years.
Right.
And they've, you know, and they've reissued it a number of times and given it different cover treatments or whatever. But
I think the most recent cover treatment has got it the best. It had the same cover for decades. That one that just seems to be some sort of formless gray, blue, purple spaceship with some other spaceship. It's difficult. It's a very 70s sci-fi cover.
Yeah.
And then they repackaged it and pitched it very young because the protagonist is a young character. And so they pitched it as almost not even a YA novel, like a tween novel, like sub-YA. And then this last go-round, they've got, I think it's Ender, and he's standing on sort of a holodecky kind of thing, and you're just looking at his back, and he's looking out on a space battle of some kind. And I think that, and it's well done. It's a nice piece of art, and I think that probably comes the closest to pitching it correctly for what it is.
Right. So, like the cover threw me off, right? And you're totally right in terms of it being like the 70s sci-fi yellowing paperback, where it's just like clearly this doesn't speak to me at all, and I'm never going to pick this up. And the people right. that really love this novel, I don't like them necessarily. So, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then opening it up this weekend, it was a real gift. So I must say that I always kind of figured that it was like a bullying revenge story or bullying like revenge fantasy that like pulled all these kids in. So it starts out that way.
Yep.
So I wasn't wholly wrong, but you have this boy, his name's Andrew Wiggin. He's like a runty picked on kid at school. He gets shoved around. He gets kind of shat on by his older brother, who's like 2 years older than him. But he's plucked from his family at the age of six by the military to go to battle school, right? So he, in that process, becomes big and strong, and the tables, of course, turn. So that's a great kind of YA storyline right there, right?
Oh, right. It's the Starship Troopers version of Harry Potter.
Well, two total. I was like, wow, this is like the whole Harry Potter arc right down to, you know, and then there's like a character named Petra in here, which reminds me of the Hunger Games, and then a Starship Troopers, of course, right? So
we should note this book is like late 70s, early 80s, so it predates Harry Potter and the Hunger Games, although it doesn't predate Starship Troopers.
Right. So when would... Anyway, so we've both read Starship Troopers.
Yes.
And I don't, like, I read it in university, actually. And I don't know if you read it, like, as an impressionable youngster, or if
I
you
did.
Read it last year when you became a cynical old man or not, but...
No, I read both of these at around the same time. I missed the fascist subtext in Starship Troopers a little bit the first time around.
Right. So like, you know, he delivers, Card delivers on just a great YA storyline on its own, right? And I was like, and I was prepared to kind of take that and be satisfied with it and go away, right? But you also get this great pre-internet story about like computers and networking and games and like fantasy reality and WoW and all this stuff. You know, and in 85, that wasn't that crazy to talk about. No, 89, 90 would have been kind of, well, no, it would have been 10 years away. Netscape would have been in 95, right? So all that Neal Stephenson, Snow Crash kind of, this isn't cyberpunky at all, but all that like precursor internet stuff. Yep. Was really enjoyable to see on the page because it's like, oh, right. because this would have read completely differently in the age of like Michael J. Fox, Back to the Future, right? Like this is kind of, it's kind of fun to see what he was thinking about, right? And a lot of that stuff has come true, and like him using slang and talking about different networks and talking about the way the news is propagated amongst all these, amongst all the Earth population in this book and stuff like that. That was just kind of a neat novelty. You also get this great military story, right? And so I'm not going to get on the show and rave about Starship Troopers for, you know, all the reasons. It's just, you know, it's too didactic. It's got all this subtext in it. But it's very much a, it's very much covering that same territory, right? So you spend a lot of time talking about what it means to be in the military and stuff like that in a way that, in fact, the U.S. Marines have put this book on their required reading list for all enlisted men, which I thought was interesting. But what you don't get is you don't get Heinlein's heavy hand, right? So Card's hand, is invisible, right? Like you don't get any of that, like any of that Mormon wacky politics that apparently he's really into in real life. You don't get a sense, like, you know, his opinions don't puncture the story at all. And I was a little worried about that when I found, when I started doing a little reading about Card, because I was like, oh, right? And it's one of those things where you don't want to judge the work by the author's biography. I wouldn't even bring that up at all, actually, to be honest, if it wasn't for the really direct comparison to Starship Troopers, right? Because Starship Troopers is such the opposite of that approach, of the approach here, that it was like, oh, right? Like, as soon as I got, as soon as you get into the military school setting, I was kind of expecting it to get kind of heavy-handed at that point because of my prior experience with Heinlein. Right. And then knowing this, knowing that that Card has is politically outspoken about these issues and others, I was like, oh, the fact that that doesn't come through at all was just was just great, right? And then so I read the 20th anniversary edition. And in the afterword, he talks about how Asimov was a big influence on him. And, and you know, in a way, this is kind of a novel in reaction to the Vietnam War. It was conceived of in 67, the short story novella that grew out to be the book was written in 75, and then the novel itself came out in 85, right? So a lot of the stuff that that surfaces has echoes in the American experience in Vietnam. And so he talks about how one of the great joys was discovering Asimov, and Asimov being, you know, I haven't read deeply with Asimov's stuff, but Card himself says that, you know, Asimov is never showing the hand of the writer in any of his opinions, right? It's always really tightly, you know, bound ideas packaged in an entertaining way, and you never get a sense of how Asimov really feels. And he was like, and that's totally what I try and do, and that's what I tried to do in this book too. And so the fact that he's now gone on and written, you know, he's also got a series based on the female characters of that appear in Genesis as well. So, and he's the great grandson of Brigham Young. so apparently, maybe that changes later on in his career. But I just thought it was noteworthy to mention here. And then my third kind of experience with the book, which was a surprise or pleasant or worthy of recommendation, was you get this really kind of interesting moral story, actually, right? Because this is essentially a story about child soldiers, child killers, in a way. And the characters are really all kind of morally ambiguous, right? Like Peter, his the character of his brother who picks on him early in the story and then plays an important role later on. He's basically a sociopath, right?
Right.
And is written in such a way that they are yin and yang with each other, right? And so you get this really sympathetic hero character in Andrew, in Ender, who then goes on to do some pretty interesting things in the plot, and then you get this kind of reprehensible character who goes on to do the opposite and has a different outcome, right? And it's like, okay, wow, you're really like you're packing in some really great kind of classroom discussion topics, right? Like I could easily see this on the school curriculum somewhere because like there's lots of stuff to talk about that goes on here. And again, cycling back to the fact that you don't know how Card himself feels because that's never telegraphed in the text. You could have endless discussions about what the real intent is here. And that was a pleasant surprise, right? So when you get to the denouement, or you get to the logical conclusion of the military arc of the story, and then he opens up kind of a can of worm of questions about what that all means. I felt really took this novel to the next level, right? And I was like, oh, that's why people are still reading it, you know, in 2011, right there, because it's not just a 6-year-old like playing war games in a simulated future.
And I think that I don't know why it suddenly popped up high onto the bestseller list, but I think it's been a consistent bestseller for the last 20 years, you know, or however long it's been, 25 years.
Right.
Because yeah, I've always seen it around. I've always seen people reading it. You know, it's always been popular, and it's nice to know that it's still, would you say it's timely or timeless? Like, is this the kind of thing that you could see people still reading in another 20 years, having read it today, so long after initial publication?
Well, I don't know how it would travel across cultures, to be honest.
Mm.
But you know, for the reasons that I mentioned, I think that it's definitely going to make a great film, and particularly if the moral ambiguity of it is left in.
I think if The Hunger Games is a huge hit, it'll go a long way towards this ending up getting made as a film, because there's a lot of child like violence between children in it, and obviously that's problematic subject material. That's the genius of the book, right? Or one of the geniuses of the book is it takes that Vietnam era notion of training soldiers and of you know, breaking them down and building them back up. And then it goes, okay, let's look at that. What if it was kids? And, you know, and we were doing these kinds of things to them. And so it introduces a sci-fi conceit in which kids are going to battle school. But I mean, obviously that's a tough thing to film and put in front of people. Right. And so I think if Hunger Games is a hit, that you might see this get out of development hell or wherever it is in the movie making process.
Right. And I don't know, like you said, there's a whole series of sequels and then a whole series of like shadow sequels, literally. so, you know, what I'd hate to see is someone some mercenary production company out there trying to mine the next Harry Potter who's going to pick this up and just like pump them out, right? Because I don't think
strip it of any subtlety. And right. again, it's going to have to be populated entirely by, not entirely, but largely by young actors who some are great, some are not.
Right. And if that treatment is taken by, if that treatment is taken both by Card himself in the series of subsequent books and or by the production company, then that would, you know, tarnish my, my enjoyment, I think. Right. Cause I think that that would just kind of ruin it. But I do see it having renewed interest, right? Particularly because, of course, there's a lot of I don't know if jingoism is the right word, but there's a lot of questions that come up about invading another country, right? If that makes sense.
And dehumanizing your opposition so that you can commit, you know,
military acts against them and stuff like that, right? And so those are kind of timeless elements that particularly resonate right now because of just kind of the American political projects that are ongoing. But again, like to get really into discussing that stuff, I'd A, have to go into spoiler territory, and then B, get political, which we both agreed we're not going to do off the top. I'm just saying that having kind of dismissed Ender's Game for years, it was a great weekend find, right? Like I was totally looking for something that was fast and genre related, and I was a little hesitant to go sci-fi, but I super enjoyed this and can definitely recommend it and be enthusiastic about it and tell people to not be swayed by any of the extraneous things, the cover or anything that you hear about it, because it's a great couple hours.
Well, man, between like Hunger Games and Leviathan and Behemoth and now this, you're having a real run of like science fiction with young protagonists. You're getting some real mileage out of these books.
Well, it's funny because the book that in run up to the show this weekend, I was like, oh, I'm going to endorse this. I'm going to be enthusiastic about that. And then about five chapters in, I got to the point where I was like, nope, pulling the plug. And that, again, is in this world of the young protagonist on an adventure. And that fell down for me. So the fact that I just kind of picked this up was a bit of an accident, to be honest.
Happy accident. All right. Well, that's it for another episode of the Enthusiastcast. We've had some wonderful emails from folks at our email account, hello@enthusiastcast.com, all of which had some great book recommendations that we've added to our massive to-be-read piles that we hope to be talking about soon on the show. As well, we've had some nice 5-star reviews on iTunes, and we want to encourage everyone to keep doing that because it's a great way to help other people find the show, and it makes us feel all warm and fuzzy. So thank you to everyone who's taken the time to reach out and be enthusiastic. Until next time, I'm John.
And I'm Mark.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers.
Thank you. Very nice.